Welcome back to Clinicians Brief, the podcast, the conversations behind the content. I'm your host, registered veterinary technician, Becky Mosser. And today's guest is back for round two of all the questions I can possibly ask. This time we're talking about hypoglycemia, an article in the September 2020 Clinicians Brief. Dr. Tom Schimmerhorn is back with us. Dr. Tom, welcome back.
Hey, thank you for having me back again. I'm looking forward to talking with you again.
Thank God. And that means I did not put you through the ringer too hard last time, that you were willing to come back, because as I professed last time, endocrine disorders are not my strong suit. And we had such a great conversation about your hyperglycemia article in the same September 2020 edition that we knew we had to have this conversation about hypoglycemia. Now, before we jump in there, just to remind you guys, the amazing Dr. Tom Schimmerhorn is a professor of small animal medicine, and as well as the veterinary chair at Kansas State University. He is doing tons of research, particularly on diabetes, and he is looking at other metabolic disorders as well. Last time we didn't talk about, and just kind of say that you've actually done veterinary medicine kind of all over the world now. You've been in Massachusetts, now you're over in Kansas. You went to Cornell. You've had a lot of kind of exposure. And so I kind of want to know, which was your favorite place to live so far and to do veterinary medicine? And if you had a choice, you could pick up your lab and move it anywhere, where would it be?
Well, with the knowledge that I'm actually employed by Kansas State University,
at this point,
I think I would pick Kansas State, primarily because even though I have been in a few other places, this has been my home for about 20 years, and I've been able to do everything I wanted to do here in terms of pursue my research, as well as be part of an excellent clinical team in internal medicine. My kids were all raised here, and we really enjoy living here. So Kansas State would be my choice, even though I'm not just saying that because I'm expecting a paycheck.
Yeah, there's no place like home, right? And you get to keep your job. That's fair. That's fair. Well, I love that because growing up, my dad used to tell me you can work where you want and live where you can, or live where you want and work where you can. And it sounds like you get to do both.
I do enjoy it here.
Okay, so speaking of enjoyment, you know, hyper endocrine disorders, I profess to you, are not my strong suit. I'm not the most patient person. I think it's why I thrive in emergency. Like, I'm kind of like a fix them and flip them type of person. But we know that when it comes to these endocrine disorders, it's not a short-term fix. This is not a short-term process. And I told you last time, your calm patient nature is building my confidence in slowing down when it comes to these conditions. And so let's see if it still applies to hypoglycemia. One thing, when I started the outline to talk to you today, the opening of your article hit me a lot in significance. It's hypoglycemia is a manifestation of pathological process, not a diagnosis. Can you just talk about that? Explain your thought behind that and dive in there, because that to me was really outstanding.
Well, I wish I could claim credit for the whole idea of that. But, you know, I think I wrote it that way because I wanted the readers to realize that usually when you're dealing with hypoglycemia, that's an unsatisfactory diagnosis. It's a condition, and it's a life-threatening situation sometimes, and it needs to be addressed. But the finding of it doesn't necessarily point you clearly to a particular diagnosis. In that way, it's a lot like anemia. Anemia has the same kind of situation where there's just so many things that can lead to it. Recognizing it is important, treating it's important, but just trying to track it backwards to its origin isn't always easy. And so we're talking about hypoglycemia from an endocrine standpoint, but because of that kind of cluttered background that it has, there's plenty of disorders that really wouldn't be classified as endocrine diseases that might present as hypoglycemia. And so that's where the challenge is for the practitioner, clinician, seeing a patient with hypoglycemia comes.
So along those same lines, I guess, you know, can you talk a little bit about the association? You know, unlike hyperglycemia, you talk a bit about association of only a few conditions, and kind of what are those conditions, and how do we differentiate and rule them out? Kind of just to your point there, it's a manifest to look at.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. I mean, when I have a patient with hypoglycemia, the first thing I try to run through in my mind is the context that the hypoglycemia is appearing in. So broadly, you could understand, I think, a big difference between possibilities in, say, a very young animal that's hypoglycemic and a geriatric animal that's hypoglycemic. If you can elicit a history of whether the animal has a history of diabetes that's, for which it's receiving insulin, you know, you can add another kind of possible avenue for investigating hypoglycemia. So I guess hypoglycemia can accompany a lot of diseases occasionally. Sometimes it's a more frequent finding in a smaller number of diseases. And in a few endocrine problems, it's the number one manifestation. You know, in the latter, I'm thinking insulinoma is probably the number one endocrine cause of hypoglycemia. But certainly in a patient that receives insulin on a daily basis, insulin overdose becomes a much more likely problem. Whereas a young Yorkie with hypoglycemia, you might think about, could the patient have a shunt? And is a hypoglycemia really a manifestation of just hepatic problem, say in a geriatric animal with a history of previous diagnosis of cirrhosis or something? So context really means a lot when you're sorting through it.
To that point, I'm listening and thinking, like, you know, we know that there is context, it's important, and there's investigation to be done, but it's an acute situation, right? So they present to us and they're acutely hypoglycemic in front of us. And, you know, I think I just, in my head, I'm like, you reach for the Karo syrup and you go on from there. Like, is that right? Is that best practices? Is it good to leave them hypoglycemic while we're investigating? First, get the glucose up? Are we doing the right thing there?
I think, yeah, your first instinct is absolutely right. You know, and that's maybe where we get lucky, because treating hypoglycemia with the intention of restoring blood sugar to normal is never going to be the wrong thing. And so that kind of first response to recognizing hypoglycemia is absolutely life-saving and a realistic way to approach it. You really want to do is kind of get yourself out of the hypoglycemic crisis so you can get a little breathing room to think about why there's hypoglycemia to begin with. And so, no, it's not the wrong thing to do. And it would probably be not recommended to allow hypoglycemia to persist just because it's such a life-threatening metabolic disturbance. I mean, when you think about the consequences, particularly on CNS, of hypoglycemia, it should be reversed as soon as it's recognized. Not only saying it's going to be easy, because sometimes, as you may be aware, simple Karo syrup won't do it, or injectable glucose won't do it, because whatever the process is really chewing up glucose, it may be difficult to reverse, but it's always important to try.
And when we have those guys, how much do we have to concern ourselves with making them hyperglycemic in that moment? I mean, there's no recommended dose of Karo syrup, you know, we're just throwing it on the gums and checking and checking. How should we navigate that acute situation? Are we comfortable? You know, how often should we test? How long does it take? Kind of what does that look like?
I personally don't worry too much about hyperglycemia. And if I had to give a blanket recommendation, it would be to treat first and ask questions later. And this is particularly important for people at home who may have a pet that has a risk for hypoglycemia, say a diabetic patient or a patient that's being managed for insulinoma. In those situations, giving them more than they need is going to be a very temporary problem, and it's not going to have any long-term consequences. The one potential place where that might matter, and this is kind of poorly defined, but there's been at least anecdotal evidence and maybe some rumors amongst clinicians that some insulinomas do respond to hyperglycemia by producing more insulin. And so in that situation, you can begin a kind of propagate ongoing vicious circle of hypoglycemia and treatment that you'd like to avoid. But you really don't know that starting out. And the real goal is to get them back to normal glycemia. And if you exceed that and they get a little high afterwards, I really wouldn't worry about it too much.
That makes me feel better. Well, you said the magic word insulinoma, so you know what I'm thinking. I know your article is mainly small animal, but, you know, we know about these exotic animal pocket pets, let's ferrets, right, that we have to deal with insulinomas and insulin dysregulation. Do you have any experience with that and the difference in pathology and treatments?
A little bit. I'm actually kind of interested in insulinoma from the research side of things, just because what we have in front of us is cells that are very good at secreting insulin. And so they're actually a good model for studying insulin secretion. But from the clinical side of things, yeah, I've come across some exotic pets, particularly ferrets, where insulinoma is a fairly common problem. They are treated pretty identically in terms of their hypoglycemia. The goal is still the same, recognize hypoglycemia and correct it. Ferret insulinoma is a little bit different than canine and feline insulinoma. It's often almost like a hyperplasia rather than a tumor per se, but that mostly ends up being relevant for understanding the disease. And there may be a few different options for ferrets in terms of treatment that are either not used as frequently in dogs or are not as available because of practical concerns like cost. But in terms of addressing the hypoglycemia, regardless of whether it's a ferret or another small animal, mammal that has hypoglycemia, it's such a uniformly pathologic process that any mammal should have the hypoglycemia corrected, which makes, again, it easier for people dealing with these guys on an emergency basis to make the right decision. You don't have to worry about being wrong if you treat their hypoglycemia.
I love that. We love anything that we know is, oh, I don't have to worry about being wrong. I'm leaning right into that. But I think it's helpful because I know as a technician, as a triage technician, I have had that thought before, like, oh, okay, no one's ever told me too much or not enough, or like some of these little tiny guys, you really do worry about, like, am I going to shoot them through the roof here? So I appreciate that a lot. So I guess I want to ask for your advice in managing stress hyperglycemia, just kind of talking about the technician aspect of it. You know, I've always kind of challenged the glucose results we see even in our normal patients, let alone ones that we're monitoring, when we know that stress is going to be a factor. How do you navigate that? How comfortable can we be with the results we're getting? Or do you have a kind of a range you work with?
Yeah, that's actually an interesting point of conversation. And I don't know if it's appropriate for me to ask the host to answer a question. But, you know, when you say you wonder about the accuracy or the validity of it, are you talking about you wonder whether the machine is registering the right value or whether the patient actually has that degree of hyperglycemia?
I guess I don't question the machine as much. More like we look at these blood results and we say, oh, stress leukogram, oh, stress glucose elevation. And we lean very quickly into the stress aspect of just sort of writing off elevations. Is that okay to do?
Yeah, no. So I actually, that's the answer I was hoping you'd say. And I'm just going to kind of ruminate a little bit about why I asked you that question. You know, to me, the glucometers that we use or the lab tests that we get with glucose are actually accurate. In other words, they're actually telling us what the concentration is in that sample. So they don't make that many mistakes. It's not that it's an inaccurate glucose. It kind of comes back to what's the validity of the reading with respect to the patient, right? And so, you know, when we see a cat with stress hyperglycemia, maybe the glucose is 300. The glucose is actually 300 when we measured it. But whether the cat walks around with the 300 at home or whether it's just a reflection of the cat being in the hospital is harder to say. And I recognize that we can look at the context in which the sample was taken and make some conclusions. You know, cat was struggling. Here we often have cats that come from a long way away. They may be in a car for 2 hours before they get here. They don't ride every day, so 2 hours is a long time. And those animals might be hyperglycemic. But even the calmest appearing animal can sometimes have hyperglycemia. And that by itself doesn't mean that it's stress. And so that becomes a challenge with documenting whether persistent hyperglycemia is present, because persistence of hyperglycemia is part and parcel of declaring that an animal is a diabetic. You don't need to have glucosuria to make a diagnosis of diabetes, although it makes it easier. But what you really need is persistent hyperglycemia. Defining the upper limit is challenging, but the definition is pretty simple. So sorting through those things isn't necessarily easy. And again, you have to ask yourself the context. If the patient is hyperglycemic, but is also at your clinic because it's showing signs compatible with diabetes, maybe that's not stress after all. If the patient is limping and has stress hyperglycemia, maybe I'd give them a break and kind of make a plan with the owner to figure out whether we either see the cat or have them observe the cat at home or things like that, that might kind of push your suspicions one direction or the other.
That's validating to me, you know, because it's the thing where I love that you said the results are accurate when you took them. They are experiencing that, whether it is stress related or not, it is being experienced. But how do we factor this in for control? If we're, say, doing a glucose curve in a clinic, say we're, you know, monitoring to try to regulate our patient, how much do we need to factor that in, or are we really comfortable leaning into a range?
That is a marvelous question. I wish I had an answer that wouldn't involve opinions and dithering. the reason is, you're really asking, are the results we're seeing on a glucose curve representative of what's actually happening at home? And unfortunately, there's no real good answer for that. There's plenty of evidence in dogs and cats and people, both experiential evidence and also more formal studies that show that there's a lot of variability in glucose, period, even under the best circumstances. And so when we're faced with just a single value or a series of values that suggest hyperglycemia, treated diabetic, it is really speculative to say that that's only due to being in the clinic, which means that none of the information is relevant for trying to make decisions, or whether that's the reflection at home. You can couple that with other things, observation of clinical signs, previous data, or you can kind of pursue other tests that might yield insight. Some of the tests used in monitoring, like glycated proteins, fructosamine or A1C, or even talk to the owners about trying to do some monitoring at home with, say, a interstitial glucose monitor or something like that. And once I decide yes or no, can I believe this? Do I believe this is an accurate reflection? The range itself doesn't matter too much. It's really hard to put a fudge factor on those things when you're trying to make a decision for insulin.
Clinician's Brief offers high-quality clinical CE so you can study from home at your own pace. Courses are race-approved and designed for your busy schedule. Start a new course now, finish it whenever. Browse the collection of courses today at cliniciansbrief.com/CE. So we take into these factors into consideration, and we get our glucose curve and we feel comfortable and we've made a dose recommendation. We've educated our clients at home. What does that follow-up look like for best practices? How often should we be rechecking in the clinic, or the client be checking at home when we've made initial, you know, or even dose adjustments afterwards? And this is, I guess, assuming we've decided this hypoglycemia is related to diabetes and we're treating our patients. I guess that's the part that I probably didn't preface with, but when we get these patients stabilized, how are we going about monitoring later?
Anytime you make a dose adjustment, you know, and I think that people might do things differently depending on what the adjustment was for. If you made a dose reduction, say, because of hypoglycemia, you may expect immediate improvement in the sense that a period of hypoglycemia should not happen again. And so for monitoring that, you might look for either repeating a glucose curve, if that was how you were measuring response to insulin, or if you had a monitor at home documenting that hypoglycemia no longer occurs. If you've made an adjustment to increase insulin because of persistent hyperglycemia, or you just felt like glucose control wasn't what it needed to be, you might expect improvement in clinical signs, which can occur fairly quickly. And depending on the amount of adjustment upward, you may or may not expect there to be a hypoglycemic event. So context matters a little bit. I would typically follow up concerns about a hypoglycemia sooner than I would necessarily making a dose adjustments where I didn't think hypoglycemia was going to be a problem. So for a patient that has a dose reduction, I might be at least touching base with the owner as soon as a week or so to see how things are going, see if they've noticed any signs related to hypoglycemia. If they haven't and things seem to be going well, we may follow up at a routine time afterwards. Whereas changing a dose upwards typically may not see that patient for a week or two to give the owner time to kind of observe at home some of the things I'd expect, which is primarily going to be a reduction in clinical signs. So less water consumption, less frequent urination, things like that. In hospital, I'd have them back to look for changes in body weight that might imply loss or control or better control, things like that.
I appreciate that, and that's insightful. And it goes back to our first conversation about the teamwork aspect and, you know, how at the very least it's going to be, you know, the veterinarian, the client, and the patient working together. So I guess one thing I've seen is the sort of the frustration point for clients in the regulation and not understanding that there is some adjustments that need to be made. So how do you prep your clients or give them confidence? And how do we help our clinicians that listen talk to their clients with confidence about the fact that we don't have confidence until we go through these certain steps?
That's a really good point, because the teamwork aspect, you know, we've talked about it before. I emphasize it all the time as the most important thing, because I think setting the expectations at the onset of the diagnosis is really important. And what I will generally ask owners to work with me on is to acknowledge, okay, we have a brand new diabetic dog or cat. We're going to start insulin, and I'm starting insulin with the expectation that it's not going to be the final dose. We're going to have a dose that's a reasonable starting spot. We're going to expect to see some improvements, but almost always we're going to have to tweak that dose down the road a little bit to optimize control. I'm setting their expectations because that's what happens. But also, I don't want to overpromise something that I don't think I can deliver. So I give them a window of about a month. And I really believe this is true, that most dogs and cats, even though they're receiving insulin, they don't quite return to being themselves until about 4 to 6 weeks after they start insulin. And by that, I mean activity-wise, attitude-wise, overall kind of quality of life. They're sick, and they have a metabolic problem that is detrimental. And so just starting insulin doesn't fix that. So I'm looking at about a month to 6 weeks before we readdress with the owner things like, well, where are we? What remains left to do? And if we're still not there, which is common, they're not disappointed because I promised them too much, and they're not frustrated because this is within the window of expectation they had. And then we work on dose adjustments, lifestyle changes, things like that, because they need to get better at treating the animal too. They need to become more consistent. They need to get more comfortable with what they have to do. So it's an evolving process that has a window initially of at least a month, if not a little longer.
I think it can be so helpful to just set those expectations in that time frame. I know I get really impatient with my pets and just stare at them. You want them to be better right away. It's gut-wrenching when they're not. And so I think helping to set that expectation of time, but also give them the tools that they need to know when things are not okay and when they should step in, it takes a certain kind of communicator. And I guess for me, that makes me, you know, we talked about this in terms of hyperglycemia, but when do we need to go to a specialist with this? When do we feel like we need to bring in a specialist? And we talked about this with teamwork. Are these referral cases for us? Are they fine handled in GP? How do you recommend we go about that?
Well, I think one place where a referral might help is if you have and let's just take the diabetic example again, a diabetic patient that has occasional hypoglycemia, particularly early on, is likely to have hypoglycemia because of a relative overdose of insulin, right? There's more insulin on board than they need. And that can lead you to troubleshoot their insulin. Is it the right type of insulin? Is there a dose adjustment that needs to be made, et cetera? But I think if you have a patient that's been doing really well and suddenly starts to develop hypoglycemia on a dose of insulin that may not have been changed very recently, then you have to start wondering, well, you know, is there a contribution from some other problem here? onset of hepatic disease or something. In those situations, you may actually have to couple with a specialist to really get to the bottom of hypoglycemia there. But in insulin-related hypoglycemia, I think, again, if practitioners who are struggling with it or frustrated with it, just remember some of the stepwise goals, would they be able to handle it before necessarily getting a specialist involved? I mean, specialists are mostly to maybe do things that you can't do in your practice, or maybe because they have more experience with certain conditions. You know, some practices may not be comfortable with a glucose monitor, for example, whereas a specialty group that does a lot of monitoring like that would be all set up to do it. That may be a situation where you can get some help there. But a lot of times, practitioners, once they settle down and follow the kind of algorithms for working through these cases, become very comfortable doing it on their own.
I appreciate that insight, because I think sometimes if we lack, you know, confidence, we lean into the specialist. But, you know, I love the idea that it is a teamwork, and just having those communication points and being comfortable working it as a team is very important. Okay, so the Keep It Brief segment, you know, is more punny than anything I'm going to really hold you to. And I love to kind of put you on the spot with these fun questions, especially when it comes to something that to me needs a magic wand. So if you had a magic wand and you could change anything about regulating glucose in your patients, what would it be?
I kind of laughing because, you know, typically I wouldn't want to depend too much on magic. But in this situation, maybe a magic wand would be needed, or maybe just a call for more research and outside the box thinking. If I had a single kind of lightning bolt product that would come out of the blue, it would be an insulin that would be responsive to hypoglycemia. In other words, it worked great when hyperglycemia was present, but as normal glycemia occurred, the insulin action was less obvious and was absent during hypoglycemia. In other words, it'd essentially be as responsive as the normal glucose-insulin coupling that we see in normal patients. That's my magic product. I don't know if we'll ever see something like that, but essentially, you know, right now people trying to make artificial pancreases that infuse insulin as a ongoing real-time regulation, but a single insulin that would do all of that without having to be infused would be amazing.
You'd be making a potion more than a wand.
Yeah, right. But I have to wave something magic over it, I suppose.
We'll get you a magic cauldron. Well, I have to say, you know, no spoiler alert, but we're going to have another conversation up and coming, because this is part of a 3-part conversation that we're talking about hyper, hypo. And the next thing we'll be talking about is that insulin selection in diabetic dogs and cats. So you guys won't want to miss that. But for now, Dr. Tom Schimmerhorn, thank you so much for being here with all this amazing insight, and I'm really excited for our next conversation.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for the great questions, too.
Thanks again to today's guest for joining us, and thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. While you're there, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review. We appreciate if you leave us all the stars. You can listen to podcasts as well on our website at cliniciansbrief.com/podcasts. You can find us at facebook.com/cliniciansbrief, on Twitter at cliniciansbrief, and on Instagram at clinicians.brief. You can also drop us a line at podcast@briefmedia.com. Clinicians Brief, the podcast, is a Brief Media production, produced by Alexis Ustry, sound by Randall Stupka, hosted by me, Becky Mosser, with special thanks to production assistant Michelle Monkrez.